Zurich. All right, Mr. Riley.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Chris Riley. I'm here on behalf of the appellants in this case. I would like to discuss two points this morning. The first is whether or not this court has jurisdiction to hear this appeal. The second point is that the district court abused its discretion in deciding to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the remaining state law claims and remand this case to state court.
Did you appeal the subject matter jurisdiction?
We did not appeal the underlying subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay.
We believe there is, in fact, subject matter jurisdiction.
All right.
The parties do not dispute the fact that there is, in fact, appellate jurisdiction to decide the issue about whether or not a district court abused its discretion in remanding the case to state court.
Okay.
That is the Carlsbad case. Where the dispute between the parties arises is whether or not there was underlying subject matter jurisdiction in this case from the beginning. And in that case,
wasn't there a claim, though, clearly stated in the original complaint, a patent claim?
Yes, there was.
Well, if the original complaint had that, and that was the existing complaint at the time of removal, for the purposes of removal, why didn't that establish jurisdiction in the federal district court?
It did. There has always been subject matter jurisdiction in this case, first under the patent laws, when at the time of the removal, as the district court, correctly decided, the plaintiff's Louisiana state ownership claim depended on a determination of inventorship under the patent laws. And the court, correctly decided that particular issue. And even though they subsequently challenged that and filed a motion for reconsideration and so forth, the court continued to hold that there was, in fact, patent jurisdiction.
Okay.
So we believe there were two bases for subject matter jurisdiction. First, under the patent laws, which did not change, because you look at jurisdiction at the time of removal. And as you correctly pointed out, there was patent jurisdiction at the time of removal. Therefore, there is, in fact, subject matter jurisdiction. However, in this case, it even went further. Several months later, the plaintiffs filed a second amended complaint, which was a studied decision to take advantage of the federal forum that they were in. In that second amended complaint, they added 15 new defendants, about 140 paragraphs, and alleged federal antitrust and RICO claims. They took advantage of the forum, and they asserted these federal claims they could not otherwise assert in state court. And they did that, and that really transformed this case beyond just even an ownership claim that determined was based on inventorship, but then also added a second prong.
Okay, so what you're saying is that they had federal jurisdiction to begin with, and then even though they didn't, they had the federal court now had federal claims in addition.
Correct.
So he's got jurisdiction plus.
Correct.
So what?
Exactly. So there is, in fact, jurisdiction over this case.
All right.
Okay? Then once the federal claims were dismissed, the court then had the ability to continue to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state claims. And that's where we believe the district court erred, because the district court at that point decided to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claims and remand the case to state court. And that, we believe, was an abuse of discretion. The reason that's an abuse of discretion is the court had the discretion to do that, but you have to look at the Carnegie Mellon factors, and we laid this out in the briefs, that you look at judicial economy, fairness, comity, and whether or not it makes sense to, at that point, this far along in the case, after all the time had been
spent.
Well,
you say this far along in the case. Weren't there proceedings going on in the state court relating to the underlying facts? In fact, hadn't the plaintiffs wanted to intercede in those state court proceedings?
Yes.
And the state court, how long did the state court have litigation with reference to the lawsuit?
For a very long time. That case, the underlying case, as the district court said in one of its orders, many judicial resources have been expended on the New Orleans Crime Camera Project. And there was the original case that you're referring to went all the way through litigation, a three-month jury trial, and resulted in a verdict, and then there was a subsequent appeal. That's the case that involves many of the underlying facts that are relevant to this case. That case went on for a number of years and was all the way through a jury verdict. You are correct that they did try to intervene in that case, and many of the facts that they've alleged in the complaint in this case stem from that underlying litigation. And so you had one court deal with that all the way through a jury trial.
Uh-huh.
That underlying case then formed the basis for this case.
But and then it, you rely, I think the principal thing that you have in your favor is the length of time, right, that was involved in the federal forum, right?
Yes.
But even that length of time wasn't continuous, was it? I thought that there were some stays in the federal forum because of the proceedings that were going on in the state forum.
There were some stays in part because of some criminal proceedings that were going on that didn't relate to
how much, regardless of what it related to, how much of that absolute time that you say it was in the federal court or federal forum do you take away from that time because there was a stay? You rely on the fact that it was there before the court and it was so active and busy, but part of that time there was nothing going on because it was stayed, was it?
Well, the case really wasn't stayed. There were certain time frames where the plaintiff was getting discovery, for example, from third parties, was allowed to do third-party discovery. The parties here, we had produced...
Well, how long a period was it stayed? I guess what I'm saying is if you call a ball game at the end of the fourth inning and you suspend it and then you play it 5 months later, you don't say that the game took 6 months to play. You only played nine innings of it, and you don't get the benefit all that time in between, do you?
No, but here there wasn't a formal stay that was put in place. The plaintiffs had asked for a stay to allow for some certain criminal proceedings to go along, but the case was always active. We had produced hundreds of thousands.
Did the judge grant a stay? Maybe ask.
I don't believe the judge ever granted a stay.
All right. So I may have misread the briefs.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And so as that case continued, there was this underlying discovery. As you correctly point out, a lot of the relevant discovery was stemming from the prior civil case that Kamsoff had tried to intervene in. And so they had access to the depositions from those cases, the documents from those cases, the trial court record from those cases. And so that's the record, and in fact, the thousands of pages they discuss that form the basis for their second amended complaint. And then after their second amended complaint, the defendants again move to dismiss all of those claims. And so the court spent a significant amount of time on substantive rulings in this case. There were over 30 motions to dismiss that were filed. There were third-party insurance claims that were litigated and decided on summary judgment. There was a joint venture claim, which is the primary substance of the plaintiff's claim, there were depositions taken on it, and there was briefing, and it was fully adjudicated on summary judgment. And so the district court spent a lot of time reviewing the underlying merits of the case. And when you look at this court's precedent, one of the factors to decide whether or not there was an abuse of discretion is the amount of judicial resources that have been expended by this court or by the district court, as well as its familiarity with the claims. There's clearly familiarity with the claims when the district court took the case from the beginning, went through dozens of those motions to dismiss, looking at nearly all of the claims that had been asserted.
Was discovery over at the time that the district court remanded? Was it ready for trial?
The discovery was not complete. The court allowed the court specifically ordered depositions on the joint venture issue, and so there were lengthy depositions taken of the plaintiff and of the principals of Active and Southern, the two primary defendants. And so those depositions were taken in this case.
And perhaps it's in the briefs and I missed it. On the order that remanded the state claims, was that going back to the same state court or the same, district court or whatever you call it in the state, that had the litigation in the underlying suit, or is it different?
Different. The underlying suit was here in New Orleans. This case was filed in Baton Rouge, so it was being remanded to a totally new judge, a judge that had not decided the underlying case that was the civil case that was in New Orleans, a judge that did not obviously have anything to do with the district court proceedings. So now...
But, counsel, you're arguing that the judge who made the determination to remand the state law claims was intimately familiar with the claims.
Yes.
Well, then who better to decide which claims ought to be remanded than the judge who was intimately familiar with the claims?
He was intimately familiar with the claims, but the decision isn't really who is in the best decision to decide.
Well, it's an abuse of discretion. Is that right?
That's correct.
So we'd have to make a determination that this judge, who you say was intimately familiar with the claims, abused discretion in deciding to remand some state law claims.
Yes. And if you look at the factors from the Brookshire case and from the Batiste case and the Newport case that we discussed, those factors include, for example, whether or not the claims are novel or the state law claims are novel or complex.
And in fact, Judge Brady said no, right?
The Judge Brady said they were not novel or complex.
But are they?
They're not complex. They're standard, a trade secret claim, for example.
But if it's a complex state issue, that's support for remanding to a state court.
That's correct, but he said they were not novel or complex. Yeah. In fact,
he went ahead and remanded.
Yes, that is correct.
Is that a legal error?
I believe it's an abuse of discretion because the basis for his remand was the argument that all the federal claims were dismissed. So that gives him the discretion. But then the Carnegie Mellon factors...
Well, that's the general rule. The general rule, in the absence of a long period of time and a lot of litigation in the court, is if you dismiss this federal claims, the federal claims are not before it, we just don't get into it unless it's one of these situations that you're painting where he's intimately, it's been there for a long time. But this case is a little bit different from those cases because you had underlying litigation, some facts involved. There may not be res judicata or whatever because the parties are a little bit different, but there are things that have existed in a long time in lots of litigation in the state court. So that's the kicker in this. Now, you're not saying, and I agree with you, that the judge made a mistake. I mean, I don't know if he made a mistake by saying that it's simple and not complex, but if he didn't make a mistake, then he made a mistake in using that as a factor going the wrong way. But so what if the judge messes up one factor? I mean, the conclusion is, the overall conclusion that we got to decide is that did he abuse his discretion, right?
Yes, I noticed that my red light went on.
You can answer that question.
Okay.
You save time for rebuttal.
Okay. Yes, first of all, you are correct that is, in fact, the general rule, is that you would remand it. But as this court said in the Brookshire case and Batiste case and other cases, that rule is not absolute. No one factor is dispositive. And instead, you have to look at the specific facts of the case. And in Brookshire, the court said that our case law in the Fifth Circuit is clear that when you invest substantial judicial resources in a case, it is an abuse of discretion. And here we have the double factor of substantial time spent by this district court, substantial time spent in the underlying civil case that the plaintiff tried to get into. And so you have two courts that have already spent a lot of time in this. And if it gets remanded to state court, you're now going to have a third judge get up to speed on this particular case.
All right,
and that's an abuse of discretion.
All right, Mr. Davis.
Good morning. Mike Davis appearing on behalf of appellees Motorola and Earthlink. Your Honors, for appellees Motorola and Earthlink, this has always been only a federal case. These two defendants were brought in as defendants in the second amended complaint, which greatly expanded what had previously been alleged in the state court. For the next year and a half, Motorola and Earthlink fought plaintiffs over this case in federal court. In the first round of motions, which challenged the claims, after that first round, the plaintiffs conceded that their state law claims should be dismissed. They then filed a third amended complaint for the purpose of reinforcing or alleging new facts to keep the case in federal court to help their federal antitrust and their federal RICO causes of action. After the next round of motions, the plaintiffs then conceded to the dismissal of their federal and state antitrust actions, and that was in September of 2011. So for the next 6 months, we fought over the RICO claims, which ultimately were dismissed. The reason that we're appearing is because this has been and always was only a federal case. The plaintiffs, they fully took advantage of the federal forum. They invoked federal jurisdiction. They embraced it. And
well, they didn't file in federal court. They were moved into federal court.
That's correct. But once they did, yeah, they transformed their case into a federal case.
Yeah, that happens.
And but the odd thing is that with regard to Motorola and Earthlink, all claims were fully adjudicated in federal court.
Let me ask
dismissed?
You.
Were they dismissed?
They were dismissed.
Are there any state claims against your client?
There were, but those were dismissed.
Okay.
And for that reason, we are fearful that if there's a ruling that there never was any federal jurisdiction, we're going to have to start all over in state court. And that's why we're here, because we believe there was a full and final adjudication of all claims in federal court. Yes, sir.
All right. But you have no state claims presently pending against you.
Everything was dismissed in federal court. That's correct.
So I don't know whether you're in a position to answer the question, but all this time that you say that the federal judge used in this case, was that time used in disposing of any of the state claims or motions about the state claims, or was that all related to the federal claims?
I can only speak for my two clients. The state claims were only in the first round of motions, and they conceded and dropped those.
Okay.
However, there was one state antitrust claim that in the second round of motions, they conceded and they dropped that. Okay. They changed it from an antitrust case to a RICO, and then for the remainder of the case, we were only fighting over the RICO action.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Malasson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Let me be clear, because this case definitely hinges upon an accurate understanding as to the procedure that has taken place to date. So there's a New Orleans case going on in October of 2009. The trial's about to start. We find out some of the defendants are asking for $1.3 billion in damages. So we filed an intervention before the Honorable Rosemary Lede saying, Mr. Carlin McDonald, who's here, participated in the design of the wireless system that they're claiming that all these defendants took from them. She dismissed or denied our intervention without prejudice, so we immediately filed a state court action in the 19th Judicial District Court for the Parish of East Baton Rouge. We alleged three state law claims: ownership, joint venture, and breach of fiduciary duty. No federal claims whatsoever. Then they filed a removal and said, well, our ownership claim depended upon the patent laws because a finding of inventorship had to happen. We fought it tooth and nail before the district court. We filed a motion to remand. When he denied that, we filed another motion to amend the judgment to make it interlocutory, because basically we had three state law claims that are now in federal court, and the entire time we're saying, well, there's no federal jurisdiction, so if we go all the way to trial and we have another month-long trial like they did in New Orleans, and we spend $100,000 on expert witnesses that we can't recover the proceeds under federal law, we're stuck, because Judge Brady wouldn't let us take the interlocutory appeal to the federal circuit. So we did. We filed two federal claims to save it, to keep from spending $100,000-plus on expert witnesses that we might ultimately get an absolutely null judgment because the federal court never had jurisdiction to begin with.
What happened to the patent? Is it still pending?
Well, first, there never was a patent. It was a patent application.
All right, what happened?
And district courts do not have jurisdiction over patent applications. The director of the Patent and Trademark Office.
It was never granted?
To our knowledge.
Just an application?
Yes, it was just an application. And that was part of the whole thing, that because
is it still pending?
We have no idea. We don't know what the status of. But that was. But here's the important thing to remember about the patent application and patent jurisdiction is we've already been to the Federal Circuit in Washington, D.C. We've already litigated whether or not there was ever patent jurisdiction. And they sent us an order saying we're about to dismiss the entire appeal for lack of appellate jurisdiction unless you tell us why we should hear the case. So we all said, well, there's...
Yeah, but by that time, we're talking about two different time frames, aren't we? There's a time frame that establishes jurisdiction in the federal district court. And if you an asserted a patent claim, then the federal district court has jurisdiction. Okay. There's another time for the federal circuit determination of jurisdiction. And if at the time that you appeal to the federal circuit, if there's no longer a patent claim, it doesn't have jurisdiction because at that time there's no patent claim pending. No, the patent claim has been dismissed, completely out of the case. And so they say, we have no jurisdiction because this case doesn't present a patent case. But the times are different. So either your original jurisdiction had a patent claim or it didn't. If it did have a patent claim, the federal district court had jurisdiction. And at the time that you appealed to the federal circuit, if you no longer had a patent claim, they didn't have jurisdiction because the time that you determine jurisdiction is different.
Okay. There was never a patent claim.
Okay.
There was an ownership claim. And we told the district court over and over that inventorship is not ownership. In fact, the only person who has a cause of action for inventorship is a person like Jason Melanson or Carlo McDonald. A corporation cannot
be
declared.
Can a person assign it to
it? It can, but that's ownership.
But that wasn't done?
That's what we were litigating. It was a corporate.
Can't you assign inventorship to a company?
You can, but when you assign it, it's a legal contract. It's ownership. Two distinct theories. No, ma'am.
Okay.
There has never ever been patent jurisdiction in this case, and that is what we have fought diligently. And we ultimately were proved correct when the Federal Circuit dismissed the appeal and transferred it. So what happened is so then to save from possible financial ruination, we did. We alleged federal antitrust and we alleged federal RICO. After we prayed to take an interlocutory appeal on a patent jurisdiction, and the judge said no. Well, then the judge dismisses it on Rule 12b-1. The judge says, your federal antitrust and your federal RICO, you don't have a concrete, particularized injury under the Constitution, and I am dismissing your federal claims under Rule 12b-1. And the case law is very clear that if the court dismisses under Rule 12b-1, then there was never any federal claim brought before the court.
Was that the motion that was brought, 12b-1 or 12b-6?
Yes, ma'am. They prayed, the defendants prayed for Rule 12b-1, and the court granted it. So there were three possible federal claims. Patent jurisdiction, which never existed, ever.
Did your original complaint have a statement that CAMSOP also wanted a share of any profits from pending patents?
No, we said we claimed an ownership claim.
But you didn't make a prayer where you sought profits from pending patents.
But it was an ownership claim.
Did you say we want a share of pending patents?
We said that we want.
It's either yes or either side it or not. If you don't know, that's okay.
Well, the reason why we alleged it is because we wanted our one-third of whatever they recovered in New Orleans.
But you said you wanted a share of pending patents.
No, I don't think we said any pending patents. I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor. But regardless, the Federal Circuit has looked at this. They know patent jurisdiction. They've said there was never patent jurisdiction. That's why we're here. Really, there's only two federal claims that even.
They didn't really say that. They said that it had been dismissed in the other court, right?
No, they cited the case that I cited that said inventorship is not an essential.
The first determination of patent was before the Federal Circuit?
I'm sorry?
The first determination of whether or not there was a patent claim was before the Federal Circuit?
Yes,
not
ma'am.
Okay.
That's under 1295A. They have exclusive subject matter jurisdiction if there was ever patent jurisdiction. And they said, no, there's no patent jurisdiction, so go back to the Fifth Circuit. So there's only two claims that can support why I'm standing here today, and that's federal antitrust and RICO, and both were dismissed on Rule 12b-1. There's no more federal claims in this case. So we do. We filed a motion to dismiss for lack of appellate jurisdiction because there's no more federal claims that can support federal jurisdiction in this case. And as far as the stay, Your Honor, the stay was on Mark St. Pierre, who we also had Gregory Meffert, who one just testified last Friday in Nagin's trial, and one is possibly expected to testify. So we've had to wait in federal court for these defendants who haven't even been sentenced yet because they're still testifying in the trial that's taking place right now. Because ultimately, all the bribery and all the money that's or a part of it that's being alleged, at least from Mark St. Pierre, was because they replicated my client's company, this technology. They used illegal bribes to get the contracts. They saw what my client did. They replicated his system. They used their contacts and influence and bribes to land contracts with Donald Evans in Baton Rouge, who, after the FBI broke that they had lavished him with gifts, he was fired. Keith Thibodeau in Lafayette, they hired his wife, and he was let go because of it. And then, obviously, the infamous Greg Meffert, and he's already pled guilty because of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that he's accepted. So,
if they're hit with serious restitution, these common players between your situation and the
yes, Nagin, ma'am,
that money may go to the Nagin restitution for sentencing.
I mean, we don't know where the money's going to go. I'm just trying to highlight that we have vigorously
worried about money, trying to stay, not spend more attorney's fees and sort of recoup a judgment. There may be nothing left if the Nagin sentencing goes forward before this is resolved and wherever it's
well, technically, going. Nagin is not part of our case.
No, but those other common players are going to be sentenced after the Nagin trial.
Yes, ma'am.
I would imagine the sentence would include serious restitution, which is the money it seems like you're looking for from.
And that's a risk that we take. But I can't let my client develop a system and then have his business partners cut the backdoor deals with the city employees and all these other technology companies who've literally made tens of millions of dollars off of this and not vigorously fight in court. And we've laid out why all of the facts, I mean, it was a plausible, as far as the procedure goes, another one of the primary problems is that he dismissed our state law claims, the district court dismissed our state law claims on Rule 12b-6 with prejudice. And then he sua sponte remands us back to state court. So now I'm in a situation where, well, you didn't say my state law claims were futile based on the factual allegations. You didn't give me an opportunity to amend my complaint before you dismissed my state law claims the first time. But then you sua sponte send me back to state court with state law claims that have been dismissed with
so
prejudice.
What survived?
Very few. That's the problem. I mean, my case was gutted at the pleading stage.
Well, if you have to go try it in state court, what are the claims you're going to try? What do you have left?
We have ownership claim. You know, even though patent jurisdiction should have, if my ownership claim solely depended on inventorship, it should have been dismissed because the Patent and Trademark Office has jurisdiction over the patent application, but my ownership claim is still pending. There's a lot of claims against the Active Southern defendants that were dismissed under 1502, a state law statute, because we allege a joint venture. And basically it says that if you have shareholders and partners and joint ventures, there's time limits for suing each other. And so we said, well, we're a joint venture.
Well, you sort of morphed your ownership claim into this joint venture.
The ownership claim has always been the same.
A few pleadings later.
There were three. No, ma'am. The ownership claim has always been based on the verbal contract that they had with one another, Louisiana's accession of movables laws, and basically the joint venture agreement that we allege took place. I mean, if this is what happened. So three friends get together and say, let's compete for this contract in New Orleans because there's going to be 1,000 video cameras deployed, a lot of money. So they get together. Well, then St. Pierre and Meffert approach my client's two other purported friends and say, look, we think you can land you the contract if you can cut us in. Now, mind you, my client, Mr. McDonald, had already had an agreement. This is how we're going to do it. I'm going to do the installation. I'm going to do the maintenance. You sell the cameras, and you coordinate with the city. They had it all arranged, nice little joint venture. But then once the city officials come in and say, well, look, we can probably guarantee you that we can get you the contract if you cut us in Bandito's restaurant that's cited in the brief, well, then they go to Carlo and say, whoa, we need to change our deal. We just want to buy the equipment from you. We don't want you to install it or maintain it. So then my client comes in and says, whoa, that wasn't our deal. And in that one meeting at Bandito's restaurant in 2004 is what has ultimately caused the downfall of Gregory Meffert. Mayor Nagin's on trial. My client's company went belly up, all from this one meeting. And all of these, and the problem is all of these technology companies that are here, MMR, Dell, Cyber, you know, nothing's happened to them, but they're the ones who've walked away with tens of millions of dollars. But unfortunately, I can't get to the substantive merits of my case because I've been fighting the case at the pleading stage for the last 4 years. And I apologize if I'm emotional about it and I'm passionate about it, but this has been a frustrating case to be at the plea.
Does this go to your cross appeal?
I'm sorry?
What you're talking about now, does that go to your cross appeal? I mean, you filed a cross appeal, is that right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've had to try to rectify all of the dismissals with prejudice of my state law claims, because I can't just get remanded back to state court in the state I'm in.
Well, as regards your cross appeal, the defenders maintain that we lack jurisdiction over the cross appeal because there's no final judgment. What do you say to that?
Well, if you affirm the remand order, then I will be remanded back to state court with rulings of my state law claim dismissals with prejudice, not without prejudice to where I could refile them again, with prejudice. And the problem is I was never given an opportunity, not one, to amend my complaint after he ruled on Rule 12b-6 relative to my state law claims. But at the end of the day, all this can be rectified because there's no federal jurisdiction. There's three claims. There was three bases for federal jurisdiction, patent jurisdiction. It's not there. It never was. And the Federal Circuit ruled that way. Antitrust and RICO dismissed on Rule 12b-1. We've cited the case law. Once you dismiss it on Rule 12b-1, it was never part of a case or controversy. It cannot support federal jurisdiction. And so all we're asking is that the court closely look at the federal jurisdiction issue, realize that there was never really federal jurisdiction to begin with, and then let us go back to state, because that in itself will reverse my state law claim dismissals with prejudice and allow me to go back to state court and allow me to get the case underway like it should have been.
State court in Baton Rouge.
Yes, ma'am.
And you don't really care about the RICO and the antitrust claims.
Well, I care. I filed an appeal relative to my state law antitrust claim because there appears to be a discrepancy in the application of the Knorr-Pennington doctrine between how it applies to federal law and how it applies to state law.
Is that one of the state claims you want, the state antitrust claim?
Okay. Yes, ma'am. And we do believe, you know, as it relates to complex issues of state law, I mean, we've cited Louisiana's antitrust law and its non-application of Knorr-Pennington doctrine as a basis for why we need to go back to state court. Because there appears to be a discrepancy in the judicial decisions between how that doctrine is applied. Louisiana Supreme Court under state antitrust law has said, if you're bribing politicians, that is not a petitioning activity that's protected under the First Amendment, and therefore you don't get Knorr-Pennington immunity when you're dealing with public officials. So yes, I mean, as it relates to state law antitrust, we do want that claim to go back with us to state court, as well as all of our other state law claims. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Riley, you have 5 minutes rebuttal.
On the issue of the abuse of discretion, I think it's important to understand that there are very few state law claims left to be decided. What is left to be decided are a couple state law claims against Active and Southern, the ownership claim, a breach of contract claim, a promissory estoppel claim, and then a trade secret claim. As to Dell, there's one claim left, a trade secret claim. As to Cyber, there's just a standalone conspiracy claim. So there is not much left to be decided, which is part of the reason why we believe the district court abused its discretion to send this case back to state court and a new judge who has never studied the merits of this particular case. And what you can tell from the briefs and from the argument, and this is clear in the Brookshire case, is that a district judge abuses its discretion in remanding a case when there is a substantial risk that the plaintiff will attempt to relitigate in state court the claims that have already been decided in federal court. And that's exactly what the plaintiffs intend to do here. So much of the time that the district court spent in this case was on the state law claims. Yes, there was a motion to dismiss granted as to the federal antitrust and RICO claims, but there were also dozens of motions to dismiss granted on multiple state law claims as well. So the district court is very familiar with a lot of those state law claims because he has already reviewed them and adjudicated them as to many defendants who were completely dismissed, and then as to certain defendants who are still in the case on other claims, litigated the trade secret claim already, the promissory estoppel and breach of contract claims. They've already looked at those particular claims.
All right, so why are they interlocutory and not final?
They're interlocutory because there has not been a final judgment issued as to those particular claims.
A separate piece of paper, judgment wasn't entered.
Correct.
But it didn't dismiss all the claims. All the claims haven't been dismissed.
Correct.
All right.
There are remaining claims against Active and Southern, Dell, Cyber, and then a few of the individual defendants as well.
All right. Would you get a little bit to this and clear up for me? The basis for the Federal Circuit's dismissal.
Yes. You were correct in your question before that there is a difference in timing. When the Federal Circuit looked at this case, they were looking at the complaint that exists at the time of that appeal. The complaint that existed at the time of the Federal Circuit appeal was the second amended complaint, not the first amended complaint that was the basis for the original removal.
Yeah, but did the counsel phrase it in terms of the Federal Circuit making a determination that their ownership claim wasn't a patent claim? Did the Federal Circuit say that, or is that his characterization of why they did it?
That is his characterization. The Federal Circuit order simply said that they were transferring this case because they lacked jurisdiction over the claim.
Let's assume that, for argument purposes, that counsel is correct, that ownership itself is not a patent claim. And let's assume that you are correct, that the Federal Circuit just threw it out because at the time there was no pending patent claim. What is your best argument for the proposition that at the time of removal there was pleaded and, in fact, a patent claim in that complaint that was removed?
Because at that particular time, there was the ownership claim that the district court decided necessarily involved
well,
the determination
I know, but,
of ownership.
Well, I know, but if, is an ownership claim enough to make a patent claim?
It is if the ownership claim is based on, or the necessary to decide that, is a determination of inventorship. And what the district court said was that, and we believe correctly, that at the time of that complaint, the first amended complaint, the sole basis of the ownership claim was based on an inventorship of that technology. Now, they changed course in the second amended complaint, which is why the district court...
So the court is making that interpretation to make this determination the patent claim was presented? That was
yes.
Your argument before it.
Yes.
So that's the core of this thing, really. If we get away from abuse of discretion, the core of the thing is whether the district court, as far as jurisdiction of the district court, whether it was district court and was correct in making a determination about whether or not a patent claim was in the complaint.
No, I believe that there are
there was no patent claim in the complaint when it was removed, and there was no other federal claims, how did he have jurisdiction?
Because he had jurisdiction at the time of the patent, but the second basis was by making the Second Amendment complaint, asserting the federal law claims.
I understand that.
Right.
But when it was removed, if there wasn't a patent claim, he never had jurisdiction to allow him to have the new federal claims right, right? So there either was a patent claim or there wasn't, which was the basis of the removal.
That is correct. That's the basis for the underlying, the beginning jurisdiction. But even if the district court was wrong in that decision, then you still have the fact that there was the antitrust and RICO claim that would have cured any defect in the original removal.
So were those allegations made in the amended complaint before removal?
The
RICO and antitrust.
RICO and antitrust were after removal.
After removal.
He filed a second amended complaint. So at that point, by asserting an antitrust and RICO claim at that particular time, he cured any defect to the extent there was one in the patent claim. But in the patent basis for the ownership claim. But we don't believe there wasn't any error, but to the extent there was, that was cured because they took advantage of the federal form and asserted those antitrust and RICO claims, which there's been some discussion about whether that was under 12b1 or 12b6. The motions were under 12b6 and 12b1 because it's a little inconsistent as to whether or not lack of antitrust standing is actually a 12b6 or a 12b1 motion. And if you look at the actual language of the district court's order dismissing the claim, it's clear, he says, as to Active and Southern, there was no, quote, antitrust injury. As to the non-Active and Southern defendants, it says he's dismissing it because they're not, quote, proper plaintiffs. And so there clearly was that jurisdiction.
Thank you. We have your argument.